All right, so again, my name is Mark Pierce. I'm the CEO and founder of Stonegate Advisors. A little bit on us, so I actually started the company in 2005, so about 12 years ago. When I started, we were a strategy consulting and research firm. And then over the years, we've kind of evolved. We started building and licensing technology about 5 years ago, and now we actually more so lead with our technology. Core focus is on helping all you guys better acquire and retain your customers, but then we still provide some advisory and research services on top of it. We've got a number of products, some I've presented over the years. Our latest one, which I'll touch on today, is called Stamp, which is a account management platform all designed around bettering your acquisition and retention. We've got tools around the individual market and the Medicare market called MySubCalc and MediNav. We've got a massive market size and share database called MAV, where we help basically determine the market size and share for any segment, for any competitor, for any market in the country, and then a number of other ones. So again, excited to be here today to talk about focusing on the ASO mid-market. So we're really going to cover three major areas today. One, where should you compete? Two, what should you bring to market? And then three, how should you compete? And so I'll talk through this approach and considerations that you're going to want to have at each of these different major areas. And then I'll also touch on some of our own experiences in working with the various clients and health plans that we've done over the years. So we'll start off with where should we compete? And that's all about assessing the opportunity. So some of the stuff that I'm going to take you through, again, it's always fun going on the second day because I'm going to see things were covered. Tom did touch on some of the things that that I talked about, so I'll just kind of reiterate that. But I think as everybody knows, the ASO market is growing quite extensively at a rate of roughly 3.1% CAGR. Although as a percent of the total market, ASO has stayed relatively consistent around 60%. Now, what's interesting, though, is the concentration is very, very high. So in the analysis that we do and in our tool, basically the top four carriers hold 60% of the share, so United, Anthem, Aetna, and Cigna. So it's a very concentrated market, but that also means that there's opportunities to try and crack that concentration and get some inroads into the remainder of the market. Now, when you look at the percentage of coverage for self-insured, you actually see that the mid-market is the fastest growing segment out of all. So I think that's one of the reasons why you guys picked Let's Have a Discussion on the Mid-Market, because as you can see, it's growing at 7% CAGR, and 40% of the nearly 3 million jobs added have been self-insured since 2011. So again, very fast growing segment. You can also see churn, right? So one of the other things that's happening, so in the 3 to 199 and 200 to 999, there is a significant increase of churn that's happening in that under 1,000 segment as compared to the over 1,000 where churn is actually going down. So what that means is that the carriers that are serving these markets today are not doing the most effective job, and there's definitely an opportunity to come in and serve them. Now, when you think about your segment, so this is another very important part, where do you want to compete? There's obviously a number of different industries, and you can notice that there's the most growth happening in mining and manufacturing, financial services and retail, and then actually declines in utilities and transportation and retail. One of the things that I'm going to talk about is the importance of developing a beachfront, picking a segment that you know and can own and start there. If you try and take the shotgun approach where you're going for any and all types of companies, I think you're going to find it's much less successful. It's always good to kind of get one, two, three in a segment because then success builds upon success. So identifying your target market, which is kind of a nice segue into it. So the first thing to think about is actually laying out your market in terms of two dimensions. One is the market attractiveness, and then the second is the competitive position that you hold. So market attractiveness could be things like, do you have superior networks? Are you one of a couple carriers, or is it a highly concentrated market with multiple carriers? Same thing on market attractiveness, which is, what are the segments that are inside that market which are most attractive to you? Are those segments, in fact, growing or declining? Is there enough concentration in the mid-market size? So when you lay that all out, you begin to see essentially what you want to do, and you've got different quadrants. So if you've got a weak competitive position and the market attractiveness is, you know, frankly, high or low, you may want to do nothing. You want to focus on the areas. I don't know if this thing has a laser pointer. Nope. You want to focus on the areas up here, which we talk about investing to compete. So just first question in the room. How many people have actually done an analysis on the mid-market in your area and know exactly what specific part of the mid-market you want to focus in on? So that's concerning, right? So I would imagine a lot of people have just approached this market very opportunistically. One of the things that Tom said, which I agree wholeheartedly, is this takes a very concentrated effort if you're going to go after it. And you can't just take your fully insured and assume that you're just going to use those same folks to go after your self-insured. It takes a lot of discipline and effort to say we're going to make an investment in this market, we're going to identify the specific segment, we're going to figure out where we're going to grow our beachhead, and that's where we're going to grow first. Because if you don't, it's kind of like any business. If you don't put enough focus into it, you're going to have a hard time growing it to become a significant part of your company. So assessing your customer needs is sort of the next topic. So, you know, what, in fact, should you bring to market? So as you think about the continuum, one of the important things is there are so many different aspects of needs of that mid-market employer. Whether it's the funding and contribution, thinking about is it fully insured versus self-insured and split, we heard a lot of conversations about, you know, is it the broker driving the decision? Is it the CFO? You know, where are they in terms of consideration of stop loss, defined contribution? You've got the whole distribution channel, so who are they relying on? Are they relying on brokers, benefit consultants on their own? What's going on in your market in terms of networks? Is it narrow networks, tiered networks? And I talked a little bit yesterday about how people are starting to think about carving out pharmacy and doing unique pharmacy networks. The medical plan, is there a lot of migration and interest in CDHP, transparency, bundled offerings? And then finally, what are the needs around population health management, telemedicine, mobile? So just on this page alone, there are 6, 7, 8, 10 different dimensions. So again, I'm going to ask a question again. How many have actually done research in your market on this specific space to understand their needs? 1. Anybody else? Again, another big concern. You got to understand your market. Again, whether that is just going out and, you know, talking to brokers, actually, you know, hiring a company to go out and do a concerted effort of market research, you're going to find that the unique needs will vary, and you actually find that those unique needs will vary even within that mid-market segment, and you've got to find a way to match what your capabilities are with those unique needs. So if there's a big need around narrow networks and tiered networks because cost is the most important factor, and that's the strength that you have because you can create something with your provider-owned system, that's the area you want to go after. So I think we also touched on this yesterday, but one of the biggest drivers of people going to ASO, especially in this space, if you look, is the ACA provisions. So this is a double-edged sword right here, right? So we're saying, okay, so ACA happened. I got essential health benefits. A lot of people are trying to circumvent it. So I'm going to make an investment and go and become ASO. But just as quickly as it came, I think we talked about yesterday, it could go away, right? They could suddenly throw essential health benefits out of the way, you know, make product innovation much more important where we can do more creative things with fully insured, and you could see this market cave. So I could understand if there's some trepidation in this market as to how much you want to invest, and I just think you need to take that into consideration, and that's one of the other reasons why I said, you know, pick a focus. Pick an area. I'm big on sort of testing and learning and piloting so you can begin to grow it. So in the event that, you know, we continue to see that growth in self-insured, you're going to have a nice beachfront that's been created. But if we find that regs change and the interest in ASO market in the mid-market goes away, you haven't over-invested in it and then having a hard time to recoup that money. I think we've talked a lot about stop loss. So there's obviously significant increase in the stop loss market in terms of the total premium written. You can see it's grown from $8 billion to $15 billion. A lot of that is growth in that small and mid-sized market, and it's also been driven by that consolidation, so Tokio Marine, Sumitomo, Symetra, and Swiss Re and IHC. So again, I think there's a lot of opportunity in that stop-loss market as well. couple other considerations. So I talked about tiered networks. So the interest in these tiered narrow networks has actually declined according to Kaiser and the Mercer studies. You can see from 2012 to 2015, there's been a decrease in that interest. Now, that said, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't adopt that approach, because while narrow networks have less appeal, low cost has a lot of appeal, and unfortunately, they are not mutually exclusive. So you may have to make some decisions, and that also helps you in thinking about defining your sweet spot, right? So we just finished a big piece of research for a client, and one of the big questions were, if I'm going to consider the narrow network, what is the breadth of that mid-market size? So are they single state or multi-state? So you may say, well, fine, you know, I want to go after the mid-market players that are predominantly single state or just around, you know, my surrounding areas, so I can create a narrow network and it's appealing to them. If you find that most of the mid-market companies in your geography have people all over the country, hey, it may not be an option for you, because as we talked about, you know, once you have to tap into some of those narrow national networks, you can't be as competitive on your rates. So one of the big things, I think, for this group is thinking about finding those mid-markets that have a presence in your own specific geographies. You can also see percentage of firms adopting non-network cost strategies. So these are some of the other important things that you're going to want to emphasize in your value proposition. CDHP, a lot of interest in retail clinics, and we're seeing more and more interest in telemedicine. How many people have adopted a telemedicine solution? All right, I should have talked about that 5 years ago. These are some other important things to consider just in terms of needs. So you've got analytics. I heard performance metrics as a very key component, and that performance metrics is a big gap in the market. But you can see in terms of those that have it in place and a clear analytic strategy, between in place, planning in 2017, and considering in 2018, you know, that's almost 75%. So having the tools and technology to support that analytic strategy will be very key. You can also see some of the other things. So green is to a great extent, blue is to a moderate extent, and yellow is not at all. But right here, use some medical claim data benchmarking to make informed metric decisions. So you can see, again, performance management. Health and well-being programs, also very interesting. So when you begin to build your offerings, which I'll talk about the importance of thinking about aspects of your offerings, you know, really focusing on the needs of your market segment will be key. And that's why, again, research is so critical. I strongly encourage you to go out and talk to the market to figure out their unique needs. Understanding your competitor value proposition. So what we've done, again, is we do a ton of research and looking at, you know, what are the different players saying in the market, what's their core strengths. Each one of you has to define your own unique value proposition. So you can look at some of the nationals, right? So they're, you know, advisory for a comprehensive long-term strategy, option to join a captive group. They have a comprehensive set of add-ons, ancillary, voluntary, stop loss, and they place a lot of emphasis on technology, exchanges, health engines, accountable care, reference pricing. So be aware of what your, you know, BUCAs and your nationals are talking about, because you got to find that niche. You got to not only define, as I talked about, that select set of companies that you can serve, but what is your value proposition? Blues, you know, they talk about having a range of options, whether it's balanced funding, net funding, traditional ASO, a lot of economies of scale doing, you know, due to the single source, enhanced but predictable cash flow, and then local market presence with tailored networks, both narrowed and tiered. When you go out and you look at the blue speech in the ASO market, that's a lot of what they focus on. And then TPAs, strong, error-free claims administration, plans and customer service tailoring to meet specific needs, broader choice of vendors and carve-outs, and cost-effective engagement, population health, and transparency tools. So the reason why I bring all this up is this can be somewhat of a highly commoditized market. I think we talked about price and where you need to compete. But on the margin, you've got the opportunity to differentiate. And you've got to find that niche. What is it about you, your plan, your provider system, which makes you most attractive to those companies, and really emphasize that niche? Because otherwise, you end up just trying to compete with all of this other noise. I've always said the best way to compete is to not compete. So you've got to find the way not to compete, change the game, change the package, so you actually have something of interest out there that the others cannot offer. So what is it that's unique and special and differentiating about you that they can't replicate? defining segment-specific value propositions. So again, Tom mentioned the importance of having a unique value proposition for this particular market. So again, to reiterate, first identify a market segment you want to own. So it doesn't have to be big. I mean, you guys are all, you know, mid-sized to small players, right? It's not like you're trying to acquire a million lives. You're just trying to grow to 10, 20, 30, 50, 100,000 lives. So there are plenty of ways to have a very focused strategy identifying the companies you think are most unique and beneficial for you to serve. Then the other piece of that is you talk about the broker and benefit strategy. In that sense, too, you can actually go to that broker and benefit consultant and say very specifically, these are the accounts that we are best to serve, and here's why we're best to serve. So when they're going out and bidding it, as opposed to just saying, hey, giving them a general value proposition, go try and sell our ASO offering, you're being laser focused on what you're trying to do. So the more specific you can be, the more refined your value proposition can be, the more success you'll have in this market. Then you go out and you understand their unique needs. So again, I keep reiterating, you know, whether it's focus groups, research, whatever you do, talk to the brokers, make sure you know what they want, and then create a unique go-to-market offering. Don't simply think you can take whatever you're doing in the fully insured market and try and repackage it over to the self-insured market. You've got to create something that's very distinct for this particular segment.
Mark?
Sure.
Can I ask you a question? A lot of our plans, if they have a big self-funded account, it's their owner.
Mm-hmm.
So is there a potential, and maybe some of you are already doing this, of the other hospitals that are in your market area, and they always have a lot of employees and that's self-funded. Is there anybody who's carved that out and looked at that as a specific market, and what are you doing to differentiate yourself there because you understand the healthcare delivery side?
Great question. Geisinger?
Well, that's where most of our business is, and we definitely have a differentiating value. The entire sales team knows exactly what the value proposition is. And so what we do is we look for hospital systems that are looking to re-engineer the way they deliver care. So we take our clinical teams in, and we'll start training their clinical teams to change the way care is delivered, et cetera, higher quality, lower cost. And what we do then is use their employee population as the proof point. So we go in, and we're all talking about reporting and so forth, and we demonstrate the value every single quarter, showing them how we're driving down admits, readmits, ER, all that kind of thing. And then what we can do, once we have those proof points, then it's easy to go into the community and say, look what we did for this huge hospital system. Mr. Employer, don't you want to talk to us? So that's what we do.
Great. Who else? Oh, Mike over here.
I just wanted to mention that the Blues did it in New York with Empire. They have a separate business segment that does nothing but hospital insurance so that they self-insure their own hospital admissions and then wrap it with another self-insured product.
Mm-hmm. Who else? Anybody else owning a segment yet? Over here.
One of the things we did early on was as strange as this may sound, and it may still be available in your marketplace, but our competition couldn't do the tiered network where you take the health system, and that's tier one, and then you put another network, whether it's your own or some other network is tier two, before you go to the out-of-network on the PPO. Our ability just to do that from an administrative and benefit configuration got us in the door in addition to being provider-owned, because being provider-owned, I heard the phrase over and over, you were asking questions that we were going to ask. You understand our industry, and it made more sense to work with you. But that whole network piece, and again, I think it's being diluted because our competition are saying we need to get into that, but you may still have that in your marketplace as well.
Great. Comment back here.
At Providence, this was actually a really good strategy for us for a while. A number of our large self-insured clients were hospitals and other communities that weren't competing with us. Portland, I think as I described yesterday, was a bit of a unique market in that we have four major hospital systems that all compete with one another. And unfortunately for us, from a self-funded perspective, a number of our former clients through a bunch of consolidation activities have been swallowed up by sometimes our own system, but these other competing hospital systems. And so it's not as much of a strategy as it once was, but for a while it was a really good strategy for us.
Good. That's a great question. So has anybody now been able to parlay that approach into any other segments? Anyone? Go. You guys have? Continue. Yeah. No, behind you.
Yeah, our other strategy that's worked very well for us is the public sector. So we won the state account about 7 years ago. Since then, we've parlayed that into some of the large county accounts, some of which we already had on a fully insured basis, but since converted to self-insured or just brought straight over from a self-insured basis.
Perfect. Others? Have you been able to parlay it into any other segments? So, I mean, I can be the first one to say, again, I'm in a slightly different industry, but as I'm serving you guys, but having a referenceable client base is everything. If you're able to say, oh, I work with X, Y, Z, that level of expertise is so key, especially if you can own it, because you can tell stories about, oh, yeah, we came across this, we came across this. And when you've got clients that are on the fence, just knowing that you have that level of expertise makes all the difference. So that's why, again, it's so important to find that beachfront, own that beachfront, and grow it. I've seen it done so many times just in different modules, like United Healthcare and the Medicare market. That's how they enter a Medicare market. They develop a beachfront in one very specific market inside a state, and they own it, and they grow it, and then they kind of go to the next one, the next one, the next one. It's far better than the shotgun approach. I mean, speaking from, and I'm an entrepreneur now for almost 20 years, the worst mistakes I've ever made is when I've tried to spread myself too thin and go after too many different things. So focus, focus, focus. Any other questions or keep moving on? All right, so thinking about your offering. So I call it the six elements of product value. So there are multiple ways to think about differentiating yourself in the market, and any one of these levers could be pulled or all of these levers. And the important thing is to think about how you want to alter each one to create that unique offering in order to bring it to that select segment that you did. The first is obviously benefit design, one of the most commoditized areas and a bit difficult, but I'm going to show you in a second about how you can think uniquely about benefit design and some of the other aspects of the product attributes in bundling. And I brought up bundling yesterday. Network. I think this is one of the greatest areas where you guys can actually differentiate because you've got some great control. So whether it's network tiering, steerage, I've seen companies now actually go to very select specific networks, so there's no actually out-of-network benefit. You can only go to the one system, and they can get a 10 to 15% price decrement. I'm seeing a lot of people talk about pharmacy negotiating directly with like a CVS, a Walgreens through your PBM where you direct people into there. You know, whether you're boosting mail orders. There's a lot of things I think you can do on the network quality. Provider extenders, too. I mean, I continue to see whether that's use of telemedicine, use of retail clinics, you know, ways to create creative product designs that make yourselves different from your competition. Operational excellence. So, you know, this is a challenge for many that, you know, in the ASO market, there are economies of scale. In order to drive your admin costs down, you've got to have a certain number of lives. So I think it's interesting, as you've been talked about, ways to collaborate. I'm seeing more and more players actually go out there in the market and try and aggregate the claims management piece of this. So you guys end up becoming the sales and marketing engines in your market. You're not necessarily trying to do all the claims management yourself, so you can start to realize those operational efficiencies. Something to consider, but you know, trying to get to the lowest cost, most efficient is very important in this market. Consumer experience. So, you know, you could differentiate yourself entirely on the service model. So whether you're using different service models for ASO versus fully insured or for the employees in ASO accounts or whatever it may be, both online and offline, and really embracing, and I know there's been sessions on consumer engagement, this is a really key one because nobody does this well today. And I think the chances of you guys doing successfully is probably higher because being a little bit more contained gives you a little bit more ability to test and learn versus some of the BUCAs where they're trying to roll this stuff out across a massive organization. It's much harder to control. Distribution, you know, thinking about how you own those channels. A lot of people said, well, you know, the brokers are not that well informed in this market. They don't know how to pitch it. Well, If you're able to take a very focused target account strategy and you're able to pick a few brokers that you think can get you there, you don't need to worry about training all the brokers. You just need to pick the few brokers that you think can get you to the end game so you can get to that first step. Then you train a few more brokers, you go after a few more accounts, and you build it incrementally. And then finally, brand. Again, I heard Tom mention brand it entirely differently. So you could think about how you want to brand this product, how you want to create its own unique identity for that ASO market. So you have any one of these levers that you can pull. You can pull one or you can pull all of them. Go ahead, question here from Greg. And we didn't touch, we touched on it yesterday, but we didn't touch much, so I'd love to hear what the group has to say about that. On transparency, good and bad of transparency of pricing. Who, anybody have a comment? Over here? Oh, wait, over here first, and then over here.
We have been being asked for these tools from our employers for years, but we really haven't been able to find a decent tool. So one of our clients is forcing us, and we're moving to a new system, that it's my understanding now that not only I still have issues with the provider contracts and the proprietary nature of those contracts, so I'm not sure how we're getting over that hurdle. But our new system, I understand, is going to be able to not only show what it costs for the knee surgery, but everything that's involved in that knee surgery. So what's the whole process, the whole way through, how many PT visits, the whole bit, and project that cost by facility specific. So we're working on that, and it's expected, I'm not gonna say an expected date because I've said that 10 times and got pulled back every single time, but we should have that in the next, thank you, eventually. Good. We'll have it eventually. But clients yeah. Are really
good. Oh, I believe it. Comment over here.
So we've said several times we're among friends, so let's say hypothetically speaking you're the most expensive system in your area. I don't have anything else to say.
I would say it's table stakes for us. If we don't have it, we can't compete. So we've had the system in place now for 4 or 5 years that does exactly, I think, what Connie was describing in terms of grouping the episode together, providing the price point not only at our system but other community hospitals within our region, looks at various providers, benchmarks those. If we have quality data on providers, it'll provide that as well so that the member can make a choice. It also syncs up with their accumulator so they know right where they're at, how much it will cost them. And from a health plan perspective, my system colleagues may disagree, but it's helped us leverage our contracting a little bit as well. So it's helped keep us competitive.
Got it. Over here, yeah.
Brad and Geisinger, you just mentioned that. Are all your contracts set up in such a consistent way, you know, where you're able to say for sure this is the bundled payment, or are you providing, or are you kind of estimating a little bit and saying we think it would be about this? Because, I mean, for a surgery, a lot of times they can choose to do, you know, things in a slightly different way, and if, you know, or they're... you know, I know our contracts are full of carve-outs and other things that, you know, yes, this is this surgery, but if you get this with something else, this pays at 100, this pays 50, we carve out drugs. You know, so are your contracts set up in such a way where it really is all bundled, or are you kind of estimating?
I would say it's a little of both. For most of the services that are in the treatment cost estimator, it's fairly precise. But that said, while it's much more comprehensive than it had been, say, 10 years ago, where it was based upon a lot of averages, we still have a ways to go because there are a number of those episodes with which we can group with pretty good precision, but as you're pointing out, there are those that, you know, it starts to fall apart a little bit. But for the most part, it's been a pretty good experience for our members.
Just a question for those of you that have these tools. Are you seeing good utilization? We have a tool it's decent. It's not the best I've ever seen. It doesn't do some of the accumulator stuff. But we really, even after much marketing and engagement attempts, have very, very low utilization of the transparency tool that we have. So I'm interested. So, I mean, it seems like people say they want it. I'm just, but maybe at the group level they want it, but the members don't seem to be utilizing it. At least ours don't. So if somebody's getting good utilization, I'd love to learn some more about it.
So as a transparency tool vendor,
I was waiting.
I actually can give some response to that. Utilization tends to be low, seriously low. The only way that you're going to get utilization out of a tool is to give someone a reason to go there. So the typical transparency tool models start from the perspective of, we're going to give you transparency, you're going to go look at it, that'll be engagement, and then therefore we're getting a result. The only way that we have found to get utilization out of it is essentially from a perspective that says, give me an ROI first, which essentially says, give me a way not to just have knowledge about what a cost is, but how can I save using that cost? So that's the only way that people go back and shop again. Keep in mind a couple of different things that drive the analysis of utilization. First and foremost, you're dealing with a huge population, many of which, if you're dealing with members as opposed to employees for a moment, are never going on the tool because they're a parent or a child of an elder parent, so they're doing the search for that. So the utilization is, by definition, is going to be low just on a simple numeric perspective. Which is why you have to provide some sort of reason to go there. Now, that's part one. The second part of this is that most plan systems do not market their transparency tools. So, for example, if you put into place something like patient review system, which some plans and some systems might or might not want, depending on the relationships that they have, it adds a level of value that otherwise people would not get. Now, the statistics, the quality metrics and all that, that's really hard for the average person to understand. In fact, many systems will use terminology that people don't get. So they'll talk about providers, but people talk about doctors and hospitals. So we confuse them if we don't manage the languaging around it. We confuse them if we're not steering them with the EOBs and other methods on the overall portal to go take a look at it, the customer service people. So like everything else that Mark's been talking about, it requires a concerted planning effort in order to get your utilization up and to make it more meaningful.
Great, thank you. A few more comments and then...
Yeah, just quickly, our utilization was around 7%, and we feel like, based on the data that we're getting, that some of those people might just be accidentally using it for a provider network search, so we think that might be actually pretty inflated, so we're in the process of maybe dropping it completely or trying to move to a new model.
And so my follow-up question, and maybe Vitals is good for this as well, is there anything that's added in there aside from cost? So, for instance, for bigger events, the member's not going to have any cost incentive for one or the other. For instance, if they were going to hit their max out of pocket one way or the other, it might show them five different hospitals, and then they'd all have the same member cost. So the member's incentives are not often the same as our incentives. And especially if they're on a copay plan, you know, they're going to see the same cost regardless of where they go. So is there a strategy to try to align what the member sees with what we'd like them to do? Like, is there just a... your health plan wants you to go here option, you know, or something to that effect?
So where you have a situation where all the costs are aligned, there are a couple of different strategies that you can employ. First of all, If the costs are the same for procedure for each, no matter where they're going to go in terms of the doctor, so on and so forth, then you might want to not do pricing or the showing the pricing as it relates to an individual provider. So in some cases, we've gone the road of just giving the pricing across the top for what the procedure will take. Now, where can you add value? You can add value in terms of understanding the particular things that go into a patient's choice. So, for example, if a provider deals with a certain type of individual, LGBT, autistic child, things like that, now you begin to give some added value in terms of being able to determine where should I go because I'm unique. Location matters, accessibility, the other values that a particular provider might offer, even in terms of technology, how they communicate, so on and so forth. So there are gradations in terms of how every individual chooses a provider. Patient reviews, which I know can be a thorny point, but I think that train has left the station with Yelp and Amazon and everyone else, so I think it's an expectation now to have patient reviews. Patient reviews are the single most valuable item that we have found that is a determinant of where someone should be going for a doctor. So as a matter of fact, on our vitals.com public-facing site, we have 8 million patient reviews on the site because that's the thing that people ask. It's not that surprising. If you think about how you choose a provider in your neighborhood, you say, who do you know? Who's been really good? And so on and so forth. So, and that can lead to a strategy within the system of how do you guide some of your practitioners in order to get better reviews, meaning provide better services and so on and so forth and up the game, and that can become a differentiator as well. So there are strategies that you can employ in terms of data.
And those are all fine. I just want them to really push them to the one that was cheaper. And I can, and a lot of that stuff I can't really control whether they have the cheaper one also has good scores or is the hip one for their demographic.
So we're building a capability into our solution, which we're for now calling Referral Advisor, which allows the provider to also pick what's appropriate based on asking certain questions of the patient, and also to be able to guide them where they should send them. We provide, as an example, all of the information about family, the CUMs and the deductibles and all that, just designed to give them as much information. So I think it can be done, and if you'd like to talk about it later, I'd be happy to.
Mark?
Yeah, in our market, one of our competitors, obviously there's an ROI with transparency and getting members to, you know, find the lowest cost provider, and so they've really encouraged their membership to shop, so they actually will give you a gift card. If you go out and use the tool, they'll send you a $100 gift card. Yeah.
So, yeah. Finish up? All right. So great discussion. My last comment on that transparency, we just finished a big piece of research with a bunch of employers and brokers, and I think that's right. The adoption levels with employees is very low. One of the big things that I've heard is there's a next generation of transparency tools that are coming out that are actually, you know, more consumer-friendly. But it's important to actually integrate it all the way up front in the enrollment process if you want them to be used downstream, as opposed to just expecting when they're out there that people will find them. So how do you get people engaged when they're enrolling to understand there's a transparency tool, get them enrolled and using it at that point so they know it's there when they actually start utilizing their care? I touched on this yesterday, and this is the idea I think somebody put up on the screen. Here are all the different components of ASO. And what we've begun doing with some of our clients, especially in that mid-market, is don't think about it like an a la carte menu. Think about it like other industries approach it where they're actually bundling. You know, whether you have kind of a basic value and premier. So you can actually create these bundles. Maybe you've got a couple common anchors. You know, you have a common communication strategy, a common reporting strategy. But this is an example of how, you know, here's a case component, a wellness component, a care management component, a productivity management component. And each tier actually has a slightly different set of pre-bundled offerings. It just makes it a lot easier for you guys to communicate and actually manage it where you're not trying to do everything a la carte. So you basically are trying to get people into maybe this package and then, you know, slowly upsell them into the value and then slowly sell them up to the premier. From your systems, if you don't have that ability to carve in and carve out, it's also a much easier way to handle it so you can actually bundle stuff together that you can carve in and carve out. So I call this the tiered product model. All right, final thing is, how should we compete? So, you know, one of the first things is really defining a unique, specific marketing plan for this market. So defining what your sales objective is, you know, I want to go after XYZ markets, here's how much I want to grow, here's the way I'm going to approach my channels, here's my specific sales plan, here's my specific marketing plan. If you haven't created a unique plan for this mid-market, I strongly encourage you to do it, because otherwise what's going to end up happening is you'll find yourself taking that shotgun approach. The second, and I heard Tom mention this too, is thinking about the sales and account management team for this segment very specifically. So this is a construct of, there are three aspects to your sales. You've got sort of the organization, who runs it, what's the culture you want to cultivate, how do you want to recruit and train them, what's the structure you want to have, operations, what's the process, the technology, are you using a CRM system, what marketing materials do you want to have, how are you going to manage performance and compensation, and then your strategy, which we talked about, is what geographies you're going to go in, what channel, what product offering, what customer. All of these will ultimately drive that unique offering that you are using to go to market in that mid-market, and you have to touch on all of these because, again, if you don't, you're going to take that more shotgun approach, less focused approach. The other big thing that I talked about is qualifying those leads. So you really need to know, and the nice thing is, you know, we're not talking about a small group where you're going after hundreds or thousands. We're talking about an ASO mid-market where you may be going after 10, 20, 30, 40, right? So you've got the ability to specifically outreach to those targets you want to go after and qualify those leads. Are they serious about fully versus self-insured? What is most important to them along those continuums of different options I showed you? What are their unique needs, and how well positioned are you to address those unique needs? And then tailor your specific value proposition to them. So in a second, I'm going to show you our tool, which is called Stamp, which is not only used in a retention mode, but also an account acquisition mode where you can qualify and profile that account to make sure that whatever you are giving them, you can actually have the best aligned solution. Finally, retention is key, right? So if you win these accounts, keeping these accounts is often more important than acquiring them in the first place. So you have to take a very concerted effort in terms of retaining those accounts. Because again, the worst thing you can do is lose these accounts and have to replace that membership. How do you keep those accounts over time? So that's the tool that we've kind of created. It's called Stamp. So basically, whether you use this tool or you use market research or you use focus groups, the important thing to do is to go out and profile those accounts, not only in an acquisition mode, but also in a retention mode. What this tool basically does is it creates a dashboard for every specific account, and it tells you three component parts. The first is it'll show you the overall perspectives. So it's kind of the net promoter score, how likely are they to recommend them. So if this was in an acquisition situation, you would give them this tool and you would understand how happy they are with the current incumbent. I think Tom brought this up. So then when you look at this dashboard, you can say, well, here's what the incumbent's doing for you, but here's actually what we're going to do to tailor our offering. If you're in a retention tool, it'll tell you how well you're serving them. Then you have what's called the actual stamp scorecard. So what the stamp scorecard will do, and the graphic for some reason doesn't show up on this page, but it will actually show you a graphic of what's most important and how well you're delivering against what's most important across categories that you define. Categories can be things like product, service, communications, performance metrics, and you get a very quick snapshot as to whether you're overperforming, underperforming, or meeting expectations. And then finally, you'll get a series of what we call performance metrics. For each category, there are a series of statements that define those categories, and those statements could be things like treats me as a value customer, introduces new product innovations. And then each of those statements roll up to the category level where you can see, again, on each category how well you're performing against what's most important. This sort of dashboard, you know, whether you are, again, doing it with basic research or you're using a tool like this, is so critical because it will allow you to profile what is most important to that account and how well either you are serving them or how well the incumbent is serving them, so you can tailor your approach. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, so CRM, this tool innovation actually will integrate with any CRM system, whether you're using Salesforce, Microsoft Dynamics. It fills a void in those tools that there's no systematic way to get the voice of the customer incorporated into that tool. So this tool will reach out to your decision makers, ask them, it's like an assessment, takes them about 7 minutes, and it will populate a scorecard. every single person that answers it, you get an individual dashboard on it. Now, if there are multiple people in a company, you give it to the COO, the CFO, it'll actually roll it up to a company level. You'll see a company level dashboard. Now, the coolest thing is you actually get an account manager dashboard. So say you've got 10 account managers and each one's calling on 10 accounts. You actually will see the account manager, how each one is doing, and then can drill down and see how they're doing on each of their accounts. And say you're serving different segments, you can look at how am I doing in public sector versus hospital. So having this sort of dashboarding methodology will really help you both on understanding their unique needs, see how well you're delivering, and then ultimately trending yourself over time. You know, again, we've got several accounts that are using it, and we've proven that we will drive acquisition, retention, and net promoter score up. So, in conclusion, like I said, three component parts, really defining where should you compete, what should you bring to market, and how should you compete. The best way to compete is to not compete. So figure out your specific niche, figure out your unique bundle across those six elements of product value, make sure you're using customer feedback to directly fuel your strategy, and then finally, make it iterative. This is not like, hey, let's do a big planning process over 6-9 months, implement the strategy, let's see how it goes. This is a test and learn strategy. So it's better to pick a few small accounts, make it work, and then incrementally expand it and learn as you're going. So I'll kind of stop there. Any questions? Good. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark.